Well, good morning. Like I said earlier, we are so incredibly excited that each and every one of you guys are here with us, whether you're here in person, checking us out online, as we officially arrive at the finish line with our sixth and final part of this series that we have been calling Doubting God. And throughout the last 6 weeks of this series, we have leaned into a conversation that has often been ignored within the local church. And yet, we've decided that within Core Community Church, that this was a conversation worth happening. Because what we acknowledge about our own lives and what we believe about yours is this, is that every single one of us, as we have journeyed through our lives and the way in which we look at God and the way in which we look at faith, have undoubtedly encountered things like doubts, questions, and uncertainties. And if every single one of us have encountered that in our lives and in our faith journeys, no matter where we are or what we walk in here with, then what we believe is that that's a conversation that's worth leaning into. That's something worth acknowledging for the sake of every single one of our lives and for every single one of our futures. And so every single week, we've been leaning into the hard stuff and addressing the doubts that every single one of us find ourselves entangled in as we look at God and we look at faith on this earth. But on top of that acknowledgement that every single one of us have encountered doubts, questions, and uncertainties, what we've also leaned into during this particular series is this reality that many, if not all of us, have been fed a lie when it comes to how we process our doubts, questions, and uncertainties. You see, for many of us, we've been fed the lie that as we encounter doubts, questions, and uncertainties in our life and in our faith, we have but two choices. Choice number one is that we act as if those doubts, questions, and uncertainties don't exist. And so we move through our life and our faith journey, hiding those at every turn because we've been led to believe that if anyone within our small group, anyone within our church, found out that we were struggling with things like doubts, questions, and uncertainties, then somehow we would be less than. Or option number two, we have no idea where to go looking for answers. And there's a little bit of fear that comes along with experiencing things like doubt and questions and uncertainties. And because we don't know where to get answers and the uncertainty rises to the surface in our lives, we simply choose to run from God or run from our faith. And yet this series has been a proposal for a third option. That maybe, just maybe, in our lives, it was time for us to stop believing the lie that doubt is all bad, that somehow doubt is the enemy of faith, and for us to be able to lean into healthy conversation and acknowledging this truth that we believe with all of our hearts, that your doubt and my doubt could actually be the greatest catalyst to experiencing deeper faith. That when we lean into our doubts, questions, and uncertainties, and we have conversation and dialogue around those things, it can actually lead to a better understanding of who God is. It can give us a clearer picture of who God is and how much He loves us. And so throughout this series, we've been leaning into that reality in every single one of our stories. And as we've leaned into that reality, we've begun to tackle the different doubts that rise to the surface in every single one of our lives. Doubts that arise because of the contradiction that we experience in our world and the things we hear from our world between things like God and science. And can I believe in both of those things, or do I have to leave one on the table? The struggles that we've had in our journey as we try to justify a good and loving God when bad things happen. The struggle that every single one of us have battled as we try to figure out whether we can trust a good and loving God when what we encounter in our world are people who claim to be Christ followers who are anything but good and loving. And doubts, questions, and uncertainties that rise to the surface in the moments of our lives in which we experience incredible self-doubt. We look in the mirror and all we see looking back at us is someone that we have deemed not good enough. And given enough time in the midst of our self-doubt always translates into what we begin to believe God sees when He looks at us. That if I think I'm not good enough, then what does a perfect God think when He looks at my imperfections, my missteps, and my mistakes? And as we've journeyed through this series, what we've recognized is that that couldn't be further from the truth. And yet, as we've made our way through each and every doubt over the course of the last 6 weeks, I believe that we've left one major one on the table for our last week in this series. You see, what I believe with all of my heart is that most, if not all of us, have struggled with doubts, questions, and uncertainties that come at the hands of the way in which we look at organized religion. Am I right? That oftentimes, as we look at organized religion, what we often begin to formulate and the conclusion we often come to is this, is that organized religion in and of itself, it doesn't matter what religion it is, can oftentimes feel as if it's confusing, exclusive, and maybe a little bit legalistic. And we begin to encounter things like that when we look at faith, when we look at religion. Wouldn't all of us attest to the fact that those things are turnoffs in our life? And that those things ultimately force us to take a step back in the way in which we look at our faith, at the way in which we look at Christianity, and the way in which we look at God. And I thought that if every single one of us have struggled with that at some point in our faith journey, whether we're walking into church for the very first time this morning or whether we've been going to church for our entire lives, that we've all bumped into that in our lives in which our church or our faith has felt legalistic, it's felt confusing, and it's felt exclusive, as if some people get in and some people are out, and I'm not sure. How do I justify those things in my life and my faith and the way in which I look at God? Then it was worth having a conversation and leaning into those doubts, questions, and uncertainties in a healthy way. But as we look at that struggle in every single one of our lives and in every single one of our faith journeys, when we begin to look at Christianity exclusively through that lens, through that struggle, the doubts, questions, and uncertainties that we've had in our lives at the hands of organized religion, what we quickly come to find out is this, is that our problems, our doubts that we have with Christianity often boils down to the problems, questions, and uncertainties that we have surrounding one man, Jesus. Because newsflash, right? Jesus is the central figure of our Christian faith. And yet what we often come to find is this, is that the doubts, questions, and uncertainties that rise to the surface in our faith journey around this man, Jesus, don't derive from the way in which Jesus lived. They don't derive from the way in which Jesus loved. That oftentimes our doubts, questions, and uncertainties arise from the things in which Jesus claimed. Because when we look at the way in which Jesus loved, there's not a whole lot not to like about that. Am I right? There's not a whole lot not to jump in with both feet when we witness and read the stories of his real life and the way in which he loved on this earth. That he found a way to include people who were outcast, people in the middle of their messes, people who had a past full of mistakes. That we don't have a problem with the way in which Jesus lived. Most people love the way Jesus lived. I mean, here was a dude who went to parties and literally refilled the wine barrels, y'all. Here was a dude who, when people had nothing to eat, he was in the business of all-you-can-eat picnics on the side of the mountainside. Here was a guy who lived with such incredible humility in his life here on this earth that he found it his role to partake and what was reserved for the lowest of low servants, washing people's feet. Here was a guy who, when he lived, helped deaf people to hear, blind people to see, lame people to walk, and lepers to lose their disease. There was no issue with the way in which he loved and the way in which he lived. But where the rubber meets the road and the way in which we look at God and the Christian faith and religion as a whole, oftentimes it comes back to the things in which Jesus claimed. That in all of his humility in this time here on earth, he made some pretty bold statements. Some pretty bold statements that oftentimes came in the form of I am statements. Like there was this one time where Jesus' very good friend, a guy by the name of Lazarus, had died. And he went to visit Lazarus' two sisters. And as they were there mourning, Jesus made this statement, I am the resurrection and the life. And then he went off and did this thing that was absolutely unheard of. He told Lazarus to come out of the grave and to come back to life, and it actually happened. There was a moment where, confronted with the religious leaders of his day, they had an issue with the way in which Jesus was operating, the way in which Jesus was carrying out his time here on earth in the ministry system or the religious system that they had created. And here was Jesus going around healing people, making lame people walk, deaf people hear, blind people see on the Sabbath. How dare he? And as the Pharisees confronted him, he looked back at them and he said, I am the Lord of the Sabbath. I created this day. How dare you tell me what I can and can't do on this day? For the Sabbath was made for the benefit of man, not the other way around. Get that through your heads. But there was this moment where this guy who had been lame for life was dropped through the ceiling of the house in which Jesus was speaking in. And as this man was dropped through, Jesus said to this man, your sins are forgiven. And the religious leaders looked at him and they went into absolute hysterics. How dare you blaspheme in this way, claiming to be able to do something that you can't do? And he looked back at the religious leaders and the Pharisees and he said this, would it be easier for me to say your sins are forgiven or for me to say get up and walk? But so that you will know that the Son of Man has come, get up, walk. Take your mat and go home. And it actually happened. And then to top it all off, as if the claims weren't bold and strong enough for us to attach ourselves to, as if the claims weren't bold enough to distort the way in which we looked at religion as a whole, before Jesus went to the cross, he made maybe the boldest claim of all. We find it in John chapter 14, verse 6. Jesus said this, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one can come to the Father except through me. And for many of us, we're like, whoa, 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 Jesus, hold the phone for a second. You want to make a claim like that that seems so ridiculously exclusive. You are the only way, the only truth, the only life. You see, this kind of claim is the claim that for many of us, we've encountered moments in our life in which that is hard to swallow. Because that sounds pretty exclusive, y'all. And if you've struggled with that, as you look at Christianity, as you look at Jesus, as you look at religion as a whole, can I just say this? I get it. Does it really have to be that exclusive? Can there really only be one way? Because you've probably encountered people on this earth much like I have. People who you know have no relationship with Jesus, no interest in Jesus. Maybe they're a part of another religious system, and yet they're incredible people who do some really good things and seem to love people really well. And you're like, can it really be true that there's only one way? Or wouldn't it be so much easier for us to just shift our perspective in such a way to begin to believe a couple of things? That ultimately, wouldn't it be much more inclusive and loving for us to begin to believe that all roads lead to God? That if you just act good and do right, that ultimately don't all roads lead to God? And ultimately, if all roads lead to God, then wouldn't it just be easier and more inclusive and more loving for us to begin to believe that really all religions are just about the same? And maybe that's the biggest issue in our doubts, questions, and uncertainties. That as we begin to shift our perspective and our doubts, questions, and uncertainties to, well, really, at its core, all religions are probably the same. That's where we begin to derive our biggest issue with religion in and of itself. Because if all religions are the same, what we know and we've already talked about and the way in which we look at religion as a whole is this, is that all religions feel pretty exclusive and pretty legalistic. They feel confusing, exclusive, and legalistic. And as we look at religion, we look at Jesus, we look at our faith, and we make that determination that's confusing and it's exclusive and it's legalistic, we find ourselves taking a step back. But this morning, instead of taking a step back,
I want to challenge us one last time. What if we leaned in? What if we leaned into those thoughts, those feelings, and those questions? And we had just an honest conversation together. And we began to seek some answers and some better understanding. And we began to break those things down so that we could see God and religion and this guy named Jesus a little bit more clearly. And in doing so, I think the healthiest place to start is this. Is that oftentimes our biggest struggle comes from just lumping all religions together and deeming that all religions are just confusing and hard to understand. All religions seem to be exclusive, and some get in and some have to stay out. All religions seem to be legalistic, and there's all these rules, and there's this level that I have to reach to be in, to be good enough, and I don't know that I'll ever get there. And so I thought the fitting place for us to start was to lean into that thought that all religions are the same. And to begin to have an overview of the five major world religions that exist right here, right now, in 2023. And in doing that, I have to give this disclaimer. That as we begin to break down the five most popular world religions that exist in our world today, this is going to be a 30,000-foot view. This is going to be a quick snippet of an overview of what each of these religions believe. And the reason that I give this as a disclaimer is this, is that the short nature of the time in which we review each of these, I want this to be known, is in no way a sign of disrespect. It's simply a sign of you guys don't want to sit here and listen to me talk all day. And so we're going to take this in literally 45 seconds to a minute to just give you the overview of some of the major religions of the world for us to see in comparison what they all look like. You see, if we take Buddhism, the Buddhist religion believes that there is no God. And because there is no God, there is no afterlife. And in being no God and no afterlife, ultimately what they deem is that for our time here on earth, it is simply this reciprocal, never-ending nature of rebirths and reincarnations. That when you die, you just immediately come back as something else. And because there's no such thing as God, obviously there's no such thing as forgiveness. And because there's no such thing as God, there's no such thing as you receiving any help from God in your troubles or shortcomings in your time here on earth. We look at the Hindu religion. The Hindu religion believes that there is a God, but that the God of the Hindu religion is ultimately an impersonal God. A God who ultimately doesn't want anything to do with your troubles, your everyday life. Ultimately doesn't really want you to have access to him. And within the Hindu religion, the only way in which you gain access with the God of the Hindu religion is through things like idols, statues, figurines. And because the God of the Hindu religion is an impersonal God, they also, much like the Buddhist religion, believe that there is no such thing as forgiveness from their God. There is no such thing as their God coming in to help you in your dire straits in life. And ultimately, both the Buddhist religion and the Hindu religion believe that the good and the bad we get out of life ultimately boil down to one thing: karma. That if you do good, you get good. If you do bad, you get bad. When we look at the Muslim religion believes that there is a God. In fact, their God is Allah. And they believe that within their religious system, in contrast to the others that we've looked at already, that they have outlawed the usage of idols, statues, and figurines. It's one of the biggest no-nos that you can do in the Muslim religion. And they believe that in order to achieve good standing with Allah, it simply comes down to one thing and one thing only: what you do. Your devotion and your good works ultimately determine whether or not you are in good standing with Allah when all is said and done on this earth. The New Age religion ultimately believes that there is no such thing as a personal God. And ultimately, our goal within our time here on earth is to achieve a higher consciousness. And to achieve a higher consciousness, you do it through one thing and one thing only. You accumulate as much wisdom and knowledge as you possibly can. And ultimately, in your time here on earth, as you accumulate more wisdom and more knowledge, the ultimate ending is that you become one with the universe. That you separate yourself from this lowly world and all the brokenness of this world by becoming smarter than everybody else, more knowledgeable than everybody else, with more wisdom than everybody else. And then number five, the Christian faith. The Christian faith believes that there is a personal God. But they take it one step further. Not only is there a personal God, but there is a God who literally became man, who put on flesh and stepped onto the pages of history. And the reason why he did such a thing is because he cares about the details of our lives. He cares about our brokenness. He cares about our mistakes. He cares about our missteps. He cares about our broken hearts. And the God of Christianity ultimately, in this belief that there is such a thing for our mistakes and missteps and our brokenness of our past, he sacrificed himself to become the forgiveness that we couldn't achieve on our own. And you see, really quickly, when we simply look at the 30,000-foot view, what's really easy for us to begin to derive is this, is that while we may be able to find a degree of beauty in all religions are not the same. All religions are not the same. And frankly, it is really easy for us to derive as well, all religions don't lead to God. Why would you say that, Ben? 60% of the five major religions that we just covered either believe that there is no God or God really doesn't care about your everyday life and he's not offering you any sort of reconciliation or any sort of forgiveness in your story. You see, religions are vastly different. And yet this morning, as we have had this tendency to lump them all in together, I want to bring this series full circle. See, if you were here for week one, you know we talked about this term that often stokes some fear in those of us who have grown up in the church. It's this term, deconstruction. And we fear that word because we believe that it comes with negative connotations. And yet this word, at the purest form of its definition, is simply the act of letting go what isn't true. All of the filters that we've built up over time, what we've been told about our faith, what we've been taught growing up, how our church taught the Bible, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Letting go of all of those filters that we've accumulated over time and just seeing Jesus for who he really is. And so this morning, in all of our doubt that's associated with organized religion, I want to challenge us to one last thing. At this morning, would you be so courageous to just consider Jesus? That as you look at religion, as you look at your faith, as you look at Christianity, as you look at God, would you just consider Jesus? Not this church, not me. Not what a group of Christians have made Jesus look like. Not what you've been taught growing up in your house about religion and Christianity. Not what your college professor tried to teach you about religion and Christianity. Just Jesus. To strip it all back, to remove all the filters, and just see who he really is at his essence. And in order for us to do that, I believe with all of my heart that there are three critical areas that we must consider in order for us to just consider Jesus. The first is this, to consider the ministry of Jesus. You see, I think the best way for us to get the clearest picture of what our God's heart is and who his heart is for is to see the very people that he came to this earth to serve, the very people that he came and spent time with, right? You can get a clear picture of any person on this earth by checking out the people they spend time with and the people that they choose to love. And when we look at Jesus and his ministry, the time he spent on earth, we get a ridiculously clear picture of what his heart was and who his heart was for. You see, when we look at the ministry of Jesus, this ministry began to expose a religion that was not like any other religion. It was contrastingly different from every other religion and every other religious leader. In fact, it seemed to be in direct contrast to all the religious leaders of his day. The Pharisees and Sadducees had a big problem with Jesus. For them, there was a standard. For them, there was a pecking order. For them, there was a long list, to be exact, about 613, different rules that needed to be lived up to. And if you didn't live up to the rules, you were out. If you had a checkered past, you were out. If you had loose moral standards, you were out. If you were a servant or, heaven forbid, a woman, you were out. And yet here came this guy who lived a life that spoke differently than that. That while their religion created outcasts, he extended love. He extended inclusion. Here came this movement behind a man that changed everything. That when confronted with the Pharisees and religious leaders of his day who had set a standard, who had set the rules, the way in which religion was supposed to operate by, when he was confronted because he was doing things differently, creating a movement that was different from all of that, this was his response. But when the teachers of religious law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with tax collectors and other sinners, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with such scum?" And you see, for many of us, this has been our holdup with any religion in our lives, because we've walked into a church before and we believe that this is what the religious leaders are speaking over us. That all we are is scum. All we are is not good enough. And yet when we just consider Jesus and we push all those other filters aside, this is what we get. When Jesus heard this, he told them, "Healthy people don't need a doctor. Sick people do. I have come to call not those who think they are righteous, but those who know they are sinners." You see, the greatest part of his ministry came to those who were weakest, broken, societal outcasts, and had been forbidden from help from every other religion and religious leader. You see, even though we don't always get it right, this is the essence of what the local church was supposed to be. This is what we were supposed to be living out. This is what we were supposed to be exemplifying. This is Jesus. This is Christianity to its core. He made blind people see, deaf people hear. He made lame people to walk, lepers healthy. And here's the crazy part. None of his critics disputed the validity of his miracles. Did you catch that? None of his critics disputed the validity of his miracles. They just wanted him to stop. Because he was upsetting the apple cart. Because he was presenting an upside-down kingdom where the last became first, where the broken were put back together, where the sick were healed, where the "you're not good enough" became "you're always good enough for me." See, this is the ministry that Jesus put on display time and time again in all lives and in this world. This movement didn't make sense. But y'all, when we look at just Jesus, it didn't make sense in the most incredible way possible. And maybe that resonates with you in the same way it resonates with me. Because what y'all may not know about me is that I was a man before I was a pastor. And what that means is that my life, my past, doesn't look a whole lot different than yours. And you're like, "Ben, come on. If you knew my past, the mistakes that I made, you wouldn't be trying to compare yourself with me." Y'all, my past is full of mistakes, shortcomings, brokenness, wrong turns, times where I've chosen to say, "God, I got this on my own. I know what's best for me." Times in which I've hurt people, betrayed friends, taken the wrong turn, been in places I shouldn't have been in. And yet what I recognize about my story and my life is this, is that in spite of, not always in spite of, sometimes because of my brokenness, that my God chooses me. He chooses to use me. And in the exact same way, no matter what brokenness you've come through, the mistakes that you've made, his ministry proves that he chooses you every single time. When we peel back the layers and we consider his ministry, we see something vastly different that has the potential to change everything and to answer our questions, doubts, and uncertainties when we consider his ministry. Second, we consider his resurrection. See, ultimately, what we find is that when we look at the life of Jesus, his ministry proves wholeheartedly that he loved people. What his ministry also proves is that he hated sin. Jesus loved people, but he hated sin. And this is the most earth-shattering part of that revelation. While Jesus loved people and hated sin, our God became the very thing he hated so that we could be free from it. Our God became sin to free us from sin. He endured the scorn and the shame of a Roman cross. He hung there naked, beaten, and grasping for air in the most humiliating death in the Roman Empire. While humanity cursed him, he prayed for us. This tool that was reserved for the worst of the worst was endured by the best of the best. But what takes this story to a whole nother level is that 3 days later, he did what dead people aren't supposed to do. He did what he said he was going to do. 3 days later, when they showed up at the tomb, guess what? Nobody expected nobody. Nobody expected nobody. But the dead guy didn't stay dead. He defeated death once and for all, and when he did so, everything changed. And when his followers saw this guy that they had once seen dead, hanging lifeless to a cross, that they had transported to an empty tomb, when they saw him alive again, they wrote this and staked their lives to this. For you killed the author of life, but God raised him from the dead. And we are witnesses of this fact. Countless men wrote about the reality that they saw him, ate with him, touched him after he had been dead. And for some of us, we're like, no. It's way more plausible that these dudes just stole the dead body from the grave. Really? Do you know the 11 dudes that we're working with? 11 uneducated country boys. We are choosing to stake our belief on the fact that 11 uneducated country boys devised the greatest scheme in all of history. But not only did they devise the greatest scheme of all of history, but they went and pulled it off. Kept it a secret, and 2,000 years later, it's still spreading like wildfire across the globe. And that's not the best part. They did so with absolutely no motive or nothing to gain personally. You know what these 11 dudes got? A whole lot of pain, suffering, and loss for what they staked their lives to. Why would they do that? Why would they do such a thing? Because when a guy says he's going to die and come back to life, and then he goes off and does it, you roll with that dude. You go with what that guy said. You stake your life to it. Every single one of these disciples did that very thing, and countless others. All 11 of them, do you know what they got? Persecution to the point of, for 10 of them, execution. And for one of them, he was exiled. They tried to execute him. They literally dipped him in a pan of boiling oil And he was just like, I don't know, a bobblehead or something. He just kept coming up. John just kept coming up. And they're like, we can't kill this guy, so we'll just send him like Tom Hanks to the island. But he didn't get a volleyball. Come on, y'all, we can smile. This is what was due to them. This is what they staked their life to, because they saw it, they witnessed it, and they could not forget it. This resurrection changed everything. We consider the ministry of Jesus. We consider the resurrection of Jesus. And then lastly, we consider the message of Jesus. You see, John, the very guy I just talked about, the one who was exiled, was one of the guys who staked his life to writing the account of Jesus' time here on earth. But John was unique in his approach, because John made it his priority to explain the why behind Jesus' coming. Like Luke was a doctor, he was incredible at all the what's and all the details. Matthew saw this from like, I was broken, I was the tax collector, I was the outcast, and wrote about it that way. But John wrote about the why. And as John wanted you and I to understand the why and the power behind the why, he kept writing things like this over and over and over again. He himself. You know who John is talking about? The God of the universe. He himself is the sacrifice that atones for our sins. And not only our sins, but the sins of the whole world. Wait a second. You're telling me that our God, the God of the Christian faith, became the sacrifice that atoned for my mistakes? Yeah, but every religion is the same. No other religion can lay claim to a God who became man and laid down his life for his subjects. No other religion has a God who was willing to become man for the sole purpose of laying down his life for his subjects. A king who placed himself beneath those of us who were mistake-ridden, who had scarred past, who didn't always get it right. Tim Keller, an incredible pastor, titan of 21st century faith, who wrote some incredible things, went home this week to be with the Lord. And yet, one of Timothy Keller's most profound things that he wrote and that he researched was he looked at the ways in which the Gospels wrote out the coming of Jesus, our God putting on flesh and coming to this earth. And what he discovered when he researched the Gospels is that every single time it talked about the God of the universe putting on flesh and coming to earth, it always strategically used these two words, came into. That God came into the world. Never once does it use the words born into. And Timothy Keller made this incredible assessment. The reason why Scripture strategically uses these two words, came into, is because it signifies the reality that our God was somewhere before he was here. And this, my friends, is what differentiates Christianity from all other religions. Every other religion was derived from a human being who made the testament that either there was no God or there is a God who has no interest in being a part of this world. And yet here was Christianity, who possesses and testifies to a God who loved this world so much. What did John write? He came into this world to give himself for you and I, not to condemn the world, but to save the world. You see, every other religion makes it their end goal for us to separate ourselves from this earth, for us to separate ourselves from the world. And yet we find something vastly different in Jesus. He was not interested in separating himself or even, hang on, y'all, people who've been going to church for a long time, buckle in for a second,
or made it his goal to separate you from this world? His ultimate goal in coming to this earth was to redeem this world. And in giving us this hope, this salvation that ultimately redeems this world, for us to become partners in the mission. And he made it clear in this. I want you to know that this was a part of my goal, part of my end goal so much that when you read Revelation, it becomes clear that at the end of all of this, I will put this world back together, make it right, redeem it once again. Check this out. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain. Oh, he's talking about heaven. No, 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 no. For the old order of things has passed away. He's talking about this earth that he is working to make right again, to repair and mend and make whole again. No other religion claims to want to redeem this world, but our God came for this world. Everybody else believes that through good works and charity, you earn the right to escape this world. But he came to us to do for us what we couldn't do ourselves. He made this kingdom collide with our culture. He brought heaven to earth once and for all. He wanted us to experience eternity right now on this side of death by experiencing life and experiencing it to the full right here, right now. But for many of us, we still find this hang up. But Ben, all of this still feels ridiculously exclusive. Some people are in and some people are out. And how do I justify that? How do I jump on that bandwagon? What if I finished here? By telling you, when we just consider Jesus, that Christianity is actually the least exclusive thing that there is. Why do I believe that? Because Paul made it clear what Jesus was up to when he wrote this. For we are made right with God by placing our faith in Jesus Christ. And this is true for those of us who reach the bar, for those of us who get our act together, for those of us who always make right choices. And this is true for everyone who believes. You want some hope? There is no greater hope, no greater inclusion, no greater love than this. No matter who we are. Love and grace was made available to those of us who are most broken. It was made available in the middle of our biggest messes. That the game was changed. The rules were turned on its head when he made this statement. I haven't come for the healthy, but for those who have ever been sick. There is nothing exclusive about that kind of love. And that kind of love isn't legalistic. He came to reset the pecking order of what was important. He pushed all the rules aside and said, I desire a relationship with you so much that I'm not doing a ministry. I'm not portraying a message that lives by the rules. See, no other religion values relationship over rules. But Jesus did. He changed everything. He came for you. He came for me. Unlike any other religion in the world. You see, every other religion lives by this equation. Me plus something equals right. I have to do something, fix something, live up to something to be right. And yet Christianity wrote a whole new equation. Jesus plus nothing equals right. That there's nothing I can do. And every other religion is spelled D-O. Do better. Do more. And yet Christianity is spelled D-O-N-E.
E. It is already done. It has been done for you. And when we see that truth and the way in which God loved us in that way, what we begin to uncover is this. Is that there's nothing legalistic about that. There's nothing exclusive about that. And dare I say, there's nothing confusing about that kind of love. When we look at his ministry, we look at his resurrection, when we look at his message, and we just see Jesus, we begin to see our faith and our God. Yes, even in the middle of our doubts, questions, and uncertainties, in a completely different way. Would you pray with me? Father, sometimes when I just look at your son, I'm caught speechless. What else is there to say but thank you? What else can I do but be in absolute disbelief that the God of the universe would love me that much? That my God would put on flesh and become man. But that wasn't all. He became man to lay down his life for his subjects. He came to do for us what we couldn't do ourselves. God, we thank you for that kind of love. We thank you for including us in the middle of our brokenness and our messes. And God, when we peel back all of the filters this morning and we just see Jesus, God, would we be courageous enough to address our doubts, questions, and uncertainties, but not to allow those things to give us a distorted view of who you are and how much you love us. To see you clearer, to see you better, and to be able to move forward. With a little less doubt, some questions that are answered, and a whole lot less uncertainty because of your love and your love only. It's in your name that we pray. Amen.